Now, the Oasis of the Seas is so enormous, so huge, that earlier this month, when it passed beneath a bridge in Denmark, the captain had to retract the ship's smokestacks just to squeeze under it. And even then, the top of the stack cleared the bridge by just 2 feet. It's what you might call a nightmare scenario for Dan Yates. He owns a small company out of Portland that runs boat excursions on the Willamette River.
This is my passion. We do a lot of weddings. We do a lot of corporate functions.
This time of year is the busy season, a season that coincides with the rainy winter months. And rain, of course, means higher water levels in the Willamette River, which could pose a problem for Yates once the city of Portland builds a new bridge over the river. It's part of a proposed expansion to the city's light rail project, and down the line, Dan Yates worries that the bridge might put him out of business.
I'm concerned that the climate change that is some people are talking about for our region is going to dramatically increase the river levels, which will then make my boat unable to transit reliably underneath this bridge.
So he's asking the city to consider building the bridge higher. But Portland's Mass Transit Agency says Yates has nothing to fear. Here's the director, Robert Barnard.
Worst case scenario for climate change, for 30 years out, there'd be 13 days out of those 30 years that he wouldn't be able to pass under the bridge.
The question, what are you, is often heard by people of mixed-race heritage. And NPR's Melissa Goh, who is of Chinese and white descent, has found an answer.
My mother's family is white, about as white as Americans come. She grew up on a hilltop in Ashcamp, Kentucky, just west of the Virginia border. She tells me that if she had brought home a black man, or even anyone not from the Appalachian Hills, her father would have reached for the shotgun. Apparently, when she brought a Chinese guy up the holler, my grandfather was too stunned to react. He managed to recover in time for the wedding 5 months later. One of the things that makes being of mixed race unique is the question, what are you? Long ago, I trained myself to answer, I'm an American. It's a tidy little line that welcomes patriotic solidarity while setting up a defensive perimeter should the rest of the conversation take an ugly turn. It's a safe thing to do because another part of being mixed is being an outsider. People don't know where you fit. I tend to pass for white, but there's a whole other culture that has equal claim. So the conversation about what I am can slip fast from race to nationality. Is your father American? Well, yes. Yes, he is. It wasn't until I was older that I realized the rest of the world might feel differently. I think of my mother, angrily brushing her hair before going inside to lash the gas station clerk for telling my father to go back to where he came from. I missed my extended family's reunion dinner last month, so as usual, I called Mom for the update. Everyone looks good, by the way. No new cancer scares. And then I practically hear her eyes roll as she tells me about the bumper sticker on my cousin's car. It reads, "Somewhere in Kenya, a village is missing its idiot." That would be the work of my cousin's husband. He's her knight in shining armor, and actually saved her life once. And you couldn't find a bigger heart or a better friend. But there's nothing he likes better than giving a poke in the liberal eye. But this jab struck a tender spot. He sees the sticker as a purely political matter. I see it as unquestionably racial. I drew blood when I pointed this out, and our conversation took that ugly turn. But for me, those who question President Obama's citizenship are sending me a personal message. If your father came from somewhere else and isn't white, then you may not be American enough. To them, I'll always be an outsider. Thing is, my cousin's husband isn't one of those people. Far from it. He and my cousin have adopted 3 Chinese orphans. He'll never, ever tell them they're not as American as their blonde, blue-eyed brother. And I wouldn't dare anyone to try. So I don't understand what's so funny about that bumper sticker. It turns out, what are you isn't a question just for funny-looking people like me. It's a question each one of us has to answer. And that answer, for all of us, isn't black or white. I've been living in my skin a long time, and I know who I am. Now it's time for everyone else to figure it out.
That was NPR's Melissa Goh. You'll find more stories from our series, Beyond Black and White, at our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Last night, Senate Democrats pushed ahead with President Barack Obama's top domestic initiative. They gave him the 60 votes needed to move a health care overhaul bill to the Senate floor for a full-scale debate. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
On this vote, the yeas are 60, the nays are 39. 3/5 of the senators duly chosen and sworn having voted in the affirmative, the motion is agreed to.
And with that, one of the most anticipated procedural votes of the year, in fact, in many years, went into the history books. Technically, all it did was formally begin the Senate's health care debate, a debate that by most estimates will stretch from now until Christmas. But for Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, it was not just a vote of confidence for his leadership, but a huge boost for the health overhaul effort.
The road ahead is a long stretch, but we can't see the finish line. We have the momentum that's going to keep this process moving, I have no doubt.
Most of the suspense leading up to the vote dissipated earlier in the day. That's when the last two undeclared Democrats, Louisiana's Mary Landrieu and Arkansas's Blanche Lincoln, announced they'd join all their colleagues, plus the Senate's two independents, to move the bill forward, said Landrieu.
After a thorough review of the bill, as I said, over the last 2.5 days, which included many lengthy discussions, I've decided that there are enough significant reforms and safeguards in this bill to move forward, but much more work needs to be done.
But getting the bill to the floor for debate and getting it passed are two different mountains. In order to placate the liberals who make up the majority of his caucus, Reid embraced a so-called public option, a government-sponsored plan individuals could choose as one possibility in the new insurance marketplace for the uninsured and small businesses the measure also calls for. But several of the 60 members who voted to allow the bill to move to the floor have already announced that they won't vote for it again if that public option remains. Among them is Blanche Lincoln, who provided that pivotal 60th vote last night.
I've already alerted the leader, and I'm promising my colleagues that I'm prepared to vote against moving to the next stage of consideration as long as a government-run public option is included.
Meanwhile, Republicans apparently considered the 60 votes a foregone conclusion. They spent the rare weekend session already debating the merits of the bill. Many of their complaints had to do with the bill's cost. Most, including Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, simply brushed off a Congressional Budget Office estimate that showed the bill would actually reduce the federal deficit.
A vote in favor of this bill is a vote in favor of the spending binge that's leading to a massive and unsustainable long-term debt that will shackle our children to a future they can't afford.
Republicans also bitterly complained about the bill's abortion language. Kansas Republican Sam Brownback says the Senate bill is too permissive.
The abortion language that was included in the bill is a departure, huge departure. 30 years bipartisan federal policy prohibiting federal tax dollars from paying for elective abortions.
There's considerable debate about whether that's the case, but now that the bill's formally on the floor, there's going to be considerable debate about most of what's in the measure. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
A massive case of financial fraud is stirring up the hedge fund industry. Billionaire investor Raj Rajaratnam was arrested last month and charged with running the biggest insider trading scheme involving a hedge fund. 20 people from across corporate America have now been charged or arrested in connection with the case, and the scandal now involves some of the country's best-known companies. Joanna Chung is the U.S. financial correspondent for the Financial Times. She's been following the story and joins us from her office in New York. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Federal authorities have described this case as the biggest insider trading ring in a generation. What is it that makes this insider trader case stand out?
What's interesting to me is that, yes, Raj Rajaratnam is one of the bigger names that has emerged who has been arrested, but there's a increasing recognition of the role played by a host of supporting actors, if you will, which is another significant factor in this case, that it's not just hedge funds. Mm. It's not just a small group of people on Wall Street, but it is involving allegedly a whole group of people from across corporate America and some of the biggest names.
Big names like what?
Well, some of the people who have allegedly passed on information have come from IBM, McKinsey, which is a huge consulting company, Intel. I mean, these are household name companies. Mm. And a lot of the stocks that we're talking about that were traded on involves big companies like Hilton and Google.
Even though this doesn't center around one person like the Bernie Madoff case, there is the gentleman, Raj Rajaratnam, who headed the hedge fund at the center of this case. What do you know about him? What can you tell us about him?
Well, he is a billionaire, a hedge fund investor. I mean, he has a huge reputation in the technology industry, and he's kind of worked his way up into a really prominent position in the hedge fund industry, which is why it was such a shock when he was arrested and accused of doing these things.
Hmm. Can you tell us what's happening in the case right now? Give us a little overview.
We've had 20 people arrested so far. There are more arrests expected. Right now, the prosecutors are in the process of trying to get more people to come forward. If you look at some of the complaints that have been filed so far, you see all the people that we've spoken about so far and we've seen in the press, but you see also dozens and dozens of unnamed so-called co-conspirators. So that's an indication that this is far from over.
Government officials are saying this case marks the first use of court-authorized wiretaps in the investigation of an insider trading case. What are the implications of this, the government's more aggressive investigative efforts?
Well, the willingness to use tools and techniques more commonly associated with non-white-collar crime suggests very strongly that law enforcement officials are very serious about cracking down on financial crime. I think it is a indication that there is a tone from the very top that financial crime is going to be something that prosecutors and regulators will make a top priority to chase after.
Joanna Chung covers the U.S. markets for the Financial Times, and she joined us from her office in New York. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to NPR News.
Next month's climate change conference in Copenhagen was supposed to produce a comprehensive treaty to reduce carbon emissions. That won't happen. President Obama has already acknowledged that he doesn't believe the U.S. Senate would ratify America's participation in the treaty at this point. The consequences are unclear, but there is considerable evidence that Arctic polar bears will be among the most notable species to become extinct over the next century if climate change patterns are accurate. Richard Ellis has spent a lifetime studying and writing about sharks, whales, tuna, even mythical sea creatures, but it's polar bears he's most concerned about now, and that's the subject of his latest book on thin ice. Richard Ellis joins me from our New York studios. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Your book opens with your first encounter with a polar bear about 15 years ago. Can you describe that?
I was on an icebreaker heading for the North Pole, and we had stopped at a place just north of Spitsbergen, due north of Norway and sort of halfway to the North Pole from northern Norway. And I heard some sort of an announcement. It was about 6 o'clock in the morning. And I ran down and I saw people standing at the rail. And I ran over to the rail. It's cold and I wasn't dressed for it. But anyway, I had my camera. And there was a full-grown bear standing up on his hind legs looking at the people on leaning over the rail.
So, Richard Ellis, much of your book traces early human interaction with polar bears. Not surprisingly, these were often very cruel encounters. You write in your book that from the outset, Europeans seem to regard it as their duty to kill polar bears. And you describe one expedition led by a man named Jonas Poole near Spitsbergen, this island north of Norway. What happened?
Well, what happened not only with Poole, who was one of the first explorers that went north looking for a northeast or northwest passage.
This is in the early 17th century.
Yeah, I'm sorry. And whenever people got up there, and quite often they were beset in the ice and couldn't go anywhere at all, but here they are, they're stuck in the ice, and this strange ghost-like creature appears. And it seems to be a natural order of human behavior to shoot at it. It wasn't threatening them, and in most cases the bears did not threaten people. And yet, They shot them as often as they could because the polar bears just stood there.
And for many of these explorers, they survived because they actually ate polar bears. You talk about the famous explorer Fridtjof Nansen, the Norwegian explorer, the first man to cross Greenland. He actually trapped his ship in Arctic ice for 3 years. They lived off polar bears.
Yes, they did. And Nansen was unique in that his pursuit, if you will, of polar bears was designed for a particular reason, namely to keep him alive.
I was surprised to learn that scientists have found increasing levels of industrial pollutants and in polar bears and actually in populations that live among them, the Inuit, for example, in Greenland. Where does it come from?
The toxins in the bodies of polar bears come from coal-fired power plants south of the Arctic. All this stuff is wafted up to the Arctic. It lands either on the water or on the land, and it's consumed by the entire food chain. The top of the Arctic food chain consists of polar bears and killer whales and human beings. In other words, they eat the animals that have accumulated all these toxins. And so, polar bears are the most heavily contaminated land animals on Earth.
Richard Ellis, scientists estimate there are just about 20 to 25,000 polar bears left on the planet. And according to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, we have about 100 years left with the polar bear. And you have a chapter in your book titled, Is the Polar Bear Doomed? Is it?
Yes. The polar bear is doomed because the melting of the Arctic ice cap is not reversible. Within 50 years, it will be gone. And if it's gone, there is no place for polar bears to live. They will starve to death because what they eat is seals. And the seals live. The seals, in fact, breed on the ice cap. No ice cap, no breeding seals. No breeding seals, no food for the polar bears. No food for the polar bears, no more polar bears.
Richard Ellis is a conservationist and the author of On Thin Ice, The Changing World of the Polar Bear. Richard Ellis, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.